Welcome everyone to the Obesity Panacea podcast. My name is Travis Saunders, and today on the podcast we have Michelle Simon, and we're going to be talking a bit about obesity research and industry engagement. And this is sort of a follow-up to a podcast we did a couple weeks ago with Dr. Diane Feingood, but not exclusively. So we might talk a bit about the same issues there, but also probably some different ones. So Michelle, could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Travis. So I'm a public health attorney based in California, and I'm the author of a book called Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. And that book came out of years of following the food industry and watching how they operate and realizing that there was a story to tell about how they really lobby to undermine public policy. And so I've learned a lot over the years about this issue of industry engagement and sponsorship, and definitely have opinions about it.
Awesome. So just to start off, we might as well sort of start off with the issue that we discussed in the last podcast, and we can kind of move away from that. So Dr. Feingood's main argument is that obesity is a very complex problem, and I think everyone would probably agree with that, and that if researchers and public health advocates and industry all separate themselves and don't engage in a discussion and try to have a constructive relationship, that just increases the complexity of an already complex problem. And so she feels that having a dialogue, understanding that both sides will probably be disappointed with each other at times, and they might not always have goals that match up, but that having a dialogue is in the end beneficial to dealing with that problem. So I'm just curious to hear what your thoughts are on that sort of argument.
Well, on the complexity issue, I mean, I'm not sure having an issue be complex per se means that we need to dialogue with industry. I mean, you know, lots of issues are complex. But, you know, I guess to me the question is, what is the goal of having some kind of dialogue with industry? I certainly have no objection to talking to people in the food industry or, you know, sitting down with them in some form or another. But if the idea is that we can somehow come to an agreement on policy, or that, you know, we should look to the food industry to help shape policy, then I'm not sure that that's a worthwhile endeavor. And the question always is, are there common goals? So when you look at the goals of public health, obviously we're trying to prevent diet-related illnesses and keep people healthy. The goal of the food industry is to simply sell more products. They really have no interest. They, in fact, can't really care about the social impacts of their selling products, because their main goal has to be to sell more products. So, you know, as long as these goals remain diametrically opposed, I'm not really sure what the benefit is or outcome would be of this sort of dialogue with industry.
Now, are they always diametrically opposed? Because I know I've spoken to some people, and maybe this is sort of a unique situation, but, you know, they've said, when you look at certain products, you know, say a 700 milliliter, like a 20 ounce bottle of cola, that convincing companies to, instead of selling these large bottles, to sell, you know, smaller bottles that might be slightly marked up in price, and then, you know, you're trying to encourage people to buy a smaller volume as opposed to a larger volume, is that in any way sort of a victory, those sort of shaping those sorts of things in terms of making products slightly healthier, or is that just misdirection from the bigger issues?
I don't think it's the goal, or certainly shouldn't be the goal of public health advocates to figure out how the food industry can keep selling slightly less, you know, junky products. It's the goal of people in public health to look to help people live their lives in the most optimally healthy ways. And so, you know, it's certainly to the benefit of Coca-Cola to help, you know, to have that company try to sell 8 or 12 ounce cans instead of 36 ounce bottles, but I'm not sure how that really benefits anyone in public health. So, you know, this idea that we should somehow really work with industry to make sure they keep making money while maybe people, you know, consume slightly less junky junk food, I don't really agree with that approach. And if you, you know, analogize it to something like tobacco, you know, we would never say, well, how can we make sure Philip Morris stays in business by selling fewer cigarettes? Maybe that will help people with lung cancer. You know, while the analogy isn't precise, I think it kind of puts things in perspective. And when you look at most of the types of products that the food industry makes, there's no need to be consuming them at all. I'm not saying they should all go out of business, that we should never, you know, enjoy a Coca-Cola or a cookie. I'm saying that those things need to be far, a much smaller part of our diet than they currently are, and we shouldn't be trying to wring our hands figuring out how to, you know, kind of make them smaller portion sizes or, you know, adding nutrients to cookies, which is exactly the kind of thing that's going on right now.
And so I'm just, because I know that the sort of the smoking and tobacco analogy, I've used it sometimes myself, but I do find, I mean, there is an important difference in that, I mean, food is necessary to live and tobacco is not. And so I realize that, you know, many things are bad, but what about even trying to shift, even not from, and I may be flailing a bit here, but it just seems like saying that food is the equivalent of tobacco just seems like an overgeneralization that, again, just sort of blurs over what is really a more complicated problem than tobacco, which I think everyone can agree is bad, and it obviously causes problems, and there's no benefit to ever come from tobacco.
I agree with that. And I often will make the same point, that the analogy isn't precise for the reasons you describe. What is clear in the analogy, though, is the corporate tactics that we see in both industries. So just like the tobacco industry, the food industry is engaged in a massive PR campaign right now, which includes, deceiving people about the science of the issues, co-opting the science, co-opting a number of health groups. I mean, these are all tactics that the tobacco industry engaged in for decades until we started calling them out, and then they had to kind of back down on a lot of those types of tactics. So while it may be true that the substances are different, and of course there's way more gray area when it comes to food and tobacco, the analogy does hold when we look at how these industries are operating.
And so, and I'm glad you brought that up, because that's an excellent point. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. I'm wondering about sort of more globally. Would you say, and this is the issue that I tend to have problems with most, is what about situations where it seems like the public good on the balance is benefiting from the situation? So say, a corporation is willing to give an endowed chair for $5 million to research, and it's completely hands-off. It's, you know, following all the best practices, that they are giving money and the chair is named after them and they have no other input into anything else involved. Can there be situations like that where the public good does benefit from these food industry and research partnerships, or do you feel that on the whole they're never worth doing because the net public good is always hurt by it?
Well, a couple of things. We have to ask who's really benefiting from that type of arrangement, and actually something like that did happen precisely with the company PepsiCo giving money to Yale School of Medicine. And the dean of Yale School of Medicine said the same thing. Oh, well, they're not going to have any involvement in, you know, the direction of the research. Well, of course it benefits PepsiCo to have its name affiliated with Yale School of Medicine, so there's that. And then there's what the money, I mean, they're not just giving money for anything. In other words, the research isn't going to go to, you know, the environment. I mean, it's specifically money to look at metabolic issues around diet. That was the fellowship that was endowed. And so, and at the same time, Pepsi also set up an entire laboratory at Yale School of Medicine to look at, you know, how that company can be making so-called healthier products. So the point is, you know, we have to ask the question, is this the best use of money in medical science, you know, to be looking at how PepsiCo can keep selling products and how their products might be impacting people's health, you know, and are they really the best funder of such endeavors?
I guess this is where it gets complicated, because obviously as a researcher, there often aren't other funders. Mm-hmm. And so I honestly can't think of any labs I know of that don't have some sort of industry sponsorship, not necessarily from food industry, but from industry of one kind of another. And so that's where I know it's sort of researchers tend to be more wishy-washy on this than, say, physicians or people who are separate, because researchers are dependent on people donating money in order to do their research. So I guess you have any suggestions if someone was going to say, I will not accept any industry funding, or from the food industry at least, that where else can your funding come from?
It's interesting when people set up that kind of dichotomy. You know, like you were saying earlier, the choice is either, you know, a supersized bottle of Coke or a smaller bottle of Coke. The choices you've laid out are industry-biased funding, which will result in science that we can't trust, or no funding at all. You know, and I guess in that world, I would prefer no funding at all. And the same thing, same false dichotomy is set up in the school setting, right? So when a soda company wants to sell products through vending machines, and, you know, a tiny portion of that money goes to help fund the classroom or what have you, and the dichotomy is set up, well, you know, the school can't get that money any other way. You know, we need to stop arranging our society around these ridiculous choices. And if the situation is so dire that schools are so desperate for money that they have to get it from Coca-Cola in the process of making kids sick from those products, if the situation is so dire in research that the only way to get money is to wind up with biased research, then we have a bigger problem on our hands, and we need to look for other solutions to that problem.
Well, I don't disagree. I would never argue that we should have less funding for research, obviously. And I will say, I mean, I'm always, like most people, when I see who sponsors a study, I always take that into account and have that sort of as a little, you know, grain of salt in their findings. But, I mean, not all industry funding is necessarily biased. I wouldn't say that it is de facto biased. I think a lot of it is. But it's, do you think that it's untrustworthy, period, like in terms of pharmaceutical research as well, or mainly food industry research?
That I would say any time there's an economic interest in the outcome of science, there is an increased risk that science will be biased. Now, of course, it's true that it's not always going to be the case. Just like, you know, purely funded research or government-funded research or whatever other sources doesn't mean that scientists aren't biased in one way or another, or that the research is shoddy. But I'm saying when there is a clear economic interest in the research that's funded, and we know this from studies, this isn't just, you know, a theory or a philosophy, there have actually been reviews of research that has been industry-funded compared to research that's not been industry-funded, and it's been shown time and time again there was a bias for the research. In other words, the research that's industry funded magically comes out more often in favor of the economic interest. And so that is how we know that this is a problem.
Although there's also, I mean, to give credit where credit's due, there's also some studies showing that industry-sponsored studies do tend to be of higher quality, and that there tends to be, or not tends to be, there have been accusations of white hat bias, of people sort of looking for the effects of industry and finding it, sort of almost being biased towards finding bias.
Mm-hmm.
Not that that's necessarily true, but yeah, it is, again, adds another layer of complexity to try and figuring out, I don't know, for me at least, exactly what the right course of action is. But I think your points are well taken there. So I guess my last question for you is, sort of looking beyond just simply food industry, like I mentioned to you before, you know, I'm a physical activity researcher, so, you know, there are other industries that arguably have a greater impact on physical activity than the food industry. So should we avoid working with industry in general, sort of anyone with a financial interest in the outcome of research, or is it really the food industry that's most concerning?
No, I was speaking earlier about industry in general, and the same has been shown when it comes to the pharmaceutical industry and looking at studies that relate to their products. I mean, it's simple common sense. You know, if you have anyone that has an economic interest in the outcome, odds are that the research is going to come out in favor of that industry. And it may not be obvious. I mean, sometimes it's as simple as when research doesn't come out in the industry's favor, those studies don't get published, and so they never even see the light of day. And that is another form of bias that just may not lend itself easily to being studied. So you know, it's, and all of these issues regarding economic interests or bias or, you know, corporate tactics aren't specific to any one industry. They've been shown time and time again across industry, whether it's tobacco, alcohol, and, you know, the chemical industry, or food or pharmaceutical. I mean, there are, you know, people that study these types of cross-issue tactics, and so, it just makes sense that it wouldn't be specific to one industry. It's a pattern in practice and a concept that is across the board.
Well, great. Well, thank you for speaking with me. Is there anything else that I didn't cover that you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I think the other area of co-optation that's really troubling right now is regarding professional health organizations. So we're seeing, again, just as was the pattern with other issues, the food industry giving a lot of money to trade organizations, both in the States and Canada, to co-opt those groups. And that's a very, so far, pretty successful practice of the industry. In other words, to give money to form partnerships with the American Dietetic Association and the Canadian equivalents to, you know, sort of put their tentacles into those groups and make sure that these professionals are touting their messages. And it's something we should be really troubled by, and the members of those groups should be complaining loudly about it and should be ashamed of their trade associations for forming those sorts of partnerships.
And so I guess just one quick follow-up then. Again, and maybe this is a false dichotomy, I'm not sure, but you know, I attended a fantastic conference last summer in Toronto that was sponsored by Coca-Cola, and there was a lot of controversy over it at the conference. One of the keynote speakers spoke out about it, and it generated a lot of discussion. But the organizers pointed out that without industry sponsorship, the conference would have been basically unaffordable for me and for many delegates.
Yeah.
And sometimes the industry sponsorship for, you know, for labs that I know of doesn't go just to a single project, but it sort of goes into a slush fund that funds an awful lot of master's students and PhD students work. So I know those are sort of separate things, but I'm just wondering, what's the option then? If we get rid of industry sponsorship, what do we do?
Yeah, I really have no patience for that kind of argumentation. So I attended a journalism, in other words, a conference for journalists a few months back, and it was co-sponsored by the tobacco industry and the alcohol industry. And I mean, it was disgusting. And I questioned the organizers of the conference, who told me the same thing. Well, you know, the journalists can't afford to pay big fees, and so we have to get these sponsors to come in. And, you know, and they were even on the panel. So it wasn't just that they had given money for an ad in the program. The tobacco industry was represented, and the alcohol industry were both represented on actual panels. So they're getting to even control the program of these events. And if the alternative is, oh my God, we can't even hold the event, then isn't that better? Isn't it better for journalists to not be given the, you know, deceptive messages from the tobacco and alcohol industries than to just stay home and maybe get their sources from somewhere better?
But that's assuming that's the only thing that's going on at these conferences. That's the thing, that, you know, there's often a bit of promotion by the organizations, but there's also a lot of good things going on that are genuinely beneficial. I mean, I made a contact at this conference that's been very helpful to my PhD that I never would have made otherwise.
I agree. And you know what? Then, again, there needs to be a little more effort made to figure out how to get funding to do these conferences the right way. If they're so important, then find sponsorship that isn't so tainted, that doesn't, you know, raise these kinds of questions. And frankly, it distracts. I agree with you, there are good things that go on. But unfortunately, in that example you gave, there was a lot of wasted energy given to the controversy of Coca-Cola as a sponsor. Wouldn't it be better if they had figured out how to raise some money some other way, or maybe held a scaled-down version of the conference, or done it online, or find some alternative to having wasted time and energy arguing over what the hell was Coca-Cola doing there?
Well, I think that's an excellent point to end it on. So thank you very much, Michelle. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with me and sharing your views and giving me some very good things to think about moving forward.
Great. Well, my pleasure, Travis. Thanks for having me.
All right. Have a great afternoon.
So that was my conversation with lawyer and author Michelle Simon. As always, if you have any comments on this podcast episode or on anything else related to obesity or physical activity, we'd love to hear it. You can visit our blog at blogs.plos.org/obesitypanacea. And I would like to thank PLOS for helping to support our podcast this year. So their help is very much appreciated with the podcast, as it is with everything blog-related. So thanks to them. Just a reminder, you can also subscribe to Obesity Panacea in iTunes. You can just simply search for it in iTunes, or if you visit the show notes for this podcast on our website, there's a link there as well. And if you do subscribe in iTunes, we would really love it if you would give us a rating. That would be very helpful to us. So thanks again to everyone for listening, and we will see you again soon. Bye.